Boy, with that introduction, Sam, I'm compelled to say, hi, I'm from Washington, and I'm here to help. So can the welfare state be scaled back? And you've given me that topic as the last speaker of the last panel of the day, which really means I are between you and the Acton Institute reception, and it is probably nearly 5 o'clock somewhere here, and it certainly is in the East Coast. And I confess that there's a part of me that simply wants to run down the aisle screaming we are doomed, but at least let's go buy a beer and enjoy the evening together. But I am paid to be an optimist. It's true. Vocational presidents of nonprofits are paid to be optimists, right, Morton? It's sort of part of our job description. I do actually believe that we can scale back the welfare state, but I actually want to talk very narrowly. We've talked a lot about this thing called the welfare state today, and the how we do that is what's important. You hear the refrain among, frankly, conservatives and liberals a lot that says there ought to be a law. And the unfortunate reality is that we have that. And a lot of those oughtas are, in fact, now our nows. And in my mind, the worst of those are nows has to do with the federal regulatory leviathan as it relates specifically to the nation's economic liberty. In other words, government-created barriers to opportunity, entrepreneurship, and prosperity. Every election you hear politicians giving lip service to, let's roll back red tape, right? Let's cut unnecessary regulations. But the problem is, how much overregulation is there exactly? Because politicians don't know. I don't think the general public knows. I'm not sure even businesses that have a direct impact of it necessarily can articulate that. We know the federal government spends $3.5 trillion a year. But there is no equivalent regulatory metric of the same variety, which is obviously a significant transparency problem. And it's something that needs fixing because we can't really get our hands around the actual cost imposed by the regulatory state. It makes it very difficult to understand solutions or to understand the impact of that on our overall macroeconomy. So in other words, the first step is coming to terms with the harsh reality of the scope of the problem. And to move beyond focusing, we talk in terms of Washington having a spending problem. I would like to say we actually have a regulatory or regulating problem. So the cost of the budget, cost of the federal government is not just a $3.5 trillion budget. Last year, my colleague Wayne Cruz, in a publication that CEI has been doing for 20 years called 10,000 Commandments, we expect that the compliance cost of federal economic regulations is nearly $2 trillion in the U.S. That is slightly more than Canada's entire GDP in 2011. To bring it down to a more reasonable level, it's about $15,000 per household, which means for the average household in the United States, it's a higher budget item than everything except for housing itself. That includes healthcare, transportation, clothes, food, entertainment. And that's probably an understatement, frankly, which is the sad part, because most regulatory agencies are not actually required to report on all compliance costs. During the last 20 years, the federal government has issued nearly 88,000 rules. It's about 3,500 a year. It's about 9 per day. Now, we know in Congress, floor debates are public. Votes, of course, are public. And so voters can certainly make decisions based on the kind of behavior they're seeing their congressmen make. But regulatory agencies have zero scrutiny in the same way. So moreover, we have a legislative process that enables policymakers to hide unpopular ideas or unpleasant programs from the public by regulating them or encouraging a regulation rather than direct legislation. So, for example, requiring a company to engage in job training is easier through regulation than actually passing a new job training program. That is for all to see and argue about. And what has happened is that Congress has therefore delegated away most of its lawmaking authority to the regulatory agencies. So last year, Congress passed 72 laws. Now, that might be 72 too many. But agencies issued about 3,600 regulations, which is a difference of a factor of more than 50, something we call the anti-democracy index. Now, I do think there actually is a little bit of hope. And so the second step is recognizing there are some tools out there. And again, you've got to start somewhere. There's lots of tools, but I just want to look at three that have actually had some traction in Congress the last couple of years. There's something called the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act. In Washington speak, it's known as the RAINS Act. They love acronyms. And this would require Congress to vote on every new regulation that has an impact of $100 million or more. At the very least, it would require Congress to take a public stance on more controversial rules. The second one is something called the Regulatory Improvement Act, and it would establish an independent commission to comb through what's called the Code of Federal Regulations and search for those that are seen as obsolete, harmful, redundant, or where there's no clear benefit that can be quantified. And then they would take a package, send it to Congress, and it would essentially be an up-and-down vote. No amendments, no vote trading, no backroom deals, and it would also keep the private sector, which of course uses that system for its own anti-competitive gain as well. Some of you may recall in the 1990s, the BRAC Commission, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission, which used a similar model and effectively took the political decision-making out of reducing military bases after the close of the Cold War. And then lastly, Congress actually could mandate executive agencies to tally up the cost estimate of the rules and create a federal regulatory budget, because believe it or not, there is no requirement today for that. And it has the added benefit, I think, of highlighting how businesses, again, use those crony tactics to impose costs on their competitors through the regulatory process. Now, the third step, I think, is frankly using the existing legal structure that we have. We have the courts. We can use those, and we have used to at least delay and possibly derail major economic regulatory actions. Now, for just an example of this, I'm frankly going to point no further than my own organization's legal challenges to both Obamacare and Dodd-Frank. Our two particular court challenges to Obama's insurance exchange rule have frankly annoyed and scared the White House a bit. Some of you may recall we won that decision in July in what's called the Hulbig case at the D.C. Circuit level. We lost in the Virginia Fourth Circuit, and then we've been involved in the Oklahoma District Court that was just a week or two ago. And Indiana is pending, and it's already on a cert petition to the Supreme Court. It doesn't, of course, guarantee what the outcome is going to be, but it's at least making progress and rolling back something that is obviously quite deleterious. And then additionally, CEI is a co-plaintiff in a case we helped organize and bring attacking the Dodd-Frank financial services regulation. The problem with Dodd-Frank is it's in a way more insidious than Obamacare has been, but because of all the attention to healthcare these last several years, what's been happening with the financial sector is actually it has the potential to lock us into an inability to grow for a long period of time. We're not exactly big fans of Elizabeth Warren and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as is often the case when I go to try to see her office. You know, these days, Americans don't have a lot of confidence in the ability of politicians from either party to address these issues. And I do think things like the RAINS Act, things like the Regulatory Improvement Acts are there for the taking with literally one or two more votes and a whole lot of truth-telling if we can get that. And for budget hawks, I think it's an opportunity to prove that they are very serious about putting the nation's economy back on sound footing. And legal challenges, and I didn't even talk about some of the Freedom of Information requests, the FOIA work that we can do, can at least try to make the regulatory process more transparent or even more caustic than is often a debate around direct taxes. And then the fourth step is something that actually Joe referred to this morning, is it recognizing when we have the right political environment to make some of these changes. And I think there actually is a precedent that we can look to. How many of you remember the film Ghostbusters? Show of hands. All right. It was the most popular film of 1984. Who was the bad guy in Ghostbusters? It was not the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. It was Walter Peck, EPA agent who essentially was needlessly trying to destroy New York City. Think about that. The villain in the highest grossing movie in 1984 was the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, movie makers tend to not risk alienating moviegoers. It's not a great business model. So why were moviegoers, frankly, receptive to the EPA being the bad guy? Well, you have to remember what was going on in the years leading up to 1984. And in the late 70s, early 80s, the EPA was seen by the public as the quintessential overbearing regulatory agency. Remember all of its work with gas rationing, and it provoked a backlash against the agency. And the political reaction against the agency led not only to sort of Ghostbusters Walter Peck, but also was part of the process that ushered in Ronald Reagan after a lot of the work of Jimmy Carter, although I will give Mr. Carter credit for some of the deregulatory work that was being done in trucking and other things leading up to that. I think, in a way, we're in a similar spot now. It doesn't mean next year, doesn't even mean 2 years from now, it may not even be 5 years from now. But I suspect what is happening with what has been going on the last 6 years from the increased regulatory overreach is setting a stage for hopefully a more popular reaction. And I don't think it's not just going to come from the coal mining area of Appalachia. And a great place to start is also for voters to try to begin to actually keep Congress more accountable for its oversight duties. The last time I checked, the executive branch agencies were created by Congress, and it's Congress's responsibility to monitor them. And up until the mid-1990s, to the annoyance of whoever was in the White House, Congress actually did that. They held regular hearings to investigate what the agencies were up to. Agencies, frankly, always complied with those investigations because they knew that Congress controlled the purse strings. But in the last several decades, Congress has lost interest in oversight. And as a result, frankly, the regulatory agencies simply ignore them. When the Republicans took over in 1994, the new majority cut almost all the budgeting for investigations. Now, some of it was done in the perfectly reasonable, noble spirit of cost-cutting. Some of it was done for punitive measures, too, as is often the case in politics. But what it turned out to be was, frankly, somewhat counterproductive. A penny spent on oversight can save a dollar in unnecessary regulatory costs. Now, we talk a lot in terms, and we hear a lot about partisanship, and I have to confess that I'm not a big fan of bipartisanship. I think it's a little overrated. We don't need to bring back the duel that was involved in the 18th century, but sometimes that fighting, I think, is a healthy thing. But when it comes to what has been the personal attacking of the last decade or 15 years, I think what has happened is that Democrats and Republicans used to actually jointly investigate the executive branch to protect their constitutional role as lawmaker. And there was at least some sense that protecting Congress as an institution from executive power grabs was a worthwhile thing to do. But in the last 20 years, that has really not happened. Republicans and Democrats in Congress prefer to stick with their president, their party, and ignore sort of their constitutional authority. And it's a horrible, horrible outcome because it has been unchecked, and it has allowed what has really been the growth of the regulatory state, particularly under Clinton and Bush, and of course now in the current administration. You know, it is my hope that the American people are starting to care a bit more about regulatory overreach and the impact it has on economic mobility, the ability to change jobs, move different states. The states are actually picking up on that far more effectively than is the federal government. And hopefully, much like Ghostbusters, we'll see if we can do something about that. You know, entrepreneurial activity is so endemic to the American spirit, and I wish we could set it free. We have a phrase that exists in the halls of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which I think is appropriate here in closing, is that one does not need to teach the grass to grow, simply move the rocks off the lawn. So, thank you.
Thank you for that optimistic note. I think, for example, of the case of the Export-Import Bank, it's probably one of the first times in a long time that we've had a serious discussion about actually shutting the thing down, and the fact that the political climate exists for that tells us that there is hope, I think. Now, our esteemed executive director, Dr. Lenore Ely, has asked me to pose just one question to our speakers before opening up the discussion to the rest of the membership and guests of the society. And the question I'd like to pose to our speakers is this. If they were granted czar-like powers, not that I'm endorsing either the word czar or an approach, Tony Blair approach to politics, what's the one thing they would do to wind back the welfare state? And I don't mean preventing further growth. I mean actually reducing the size and scope of the welfare state in real terms.